Ladies and gentlemen, our first case for argument, Koyamani, if the other lawyer is here. No?
The appellant is via speakerphone.
Right.
Yes.
Where's the government lawyer?
So we're missing one.
Yes.
Half. Okay. Well, let's start with the second case then. United States versus Vance. Everybody here? So, Mr. Goodman?
Please the court, Jeff Goodman from the firm of Foldy & Lardner on behalf of the appellant David Vance. This court should reverse Mr. Vance's conviction and order a new trial for three reasons, each of which independently was error and the cumulative effect of which was to stack the deck against Mr. Vance at his trial. The first reason for reversal relates to, under Rule 404B, the district court improperly admitted evidence of three restaurant robberies that were only evidence of propensity and were not admissible for a proper purpose under Rule 404B. The second reason for reversal is that the district court failed to satisfy its gatekeeping duties under Daubert Federal Rule of Evidence 702 in admitting DNA evidence and expert testimony. And the third reason for reversal and ordering of a new trial is that the district court improperly precluded Mr. Vance from offering any evidence or cross-examining witnesses on various errors and omissions with respect to the government's handling and testing of evidence.
You're not going to discuss the sentence?
Yes, separately, Your Honor. In the alternative, although we believe a new trial is appropriate, if this court were to affirm with respect to sentencing, Mr. Vance, the district court erred in ruling that they were required to sentence Mr. Vance to life in prison under 18 U.S.C. 2113E because that statute does not require a life sentence under the circumstances of this case. With respect to the request for a new trial, I'm going to begin with the 404B evidence. The three restaurant robberies, this is classic propensity evidence. It was three restaurant robberies allegedly committed the evening before the first robbery. It's important to note there were
but
two
isn't
robberies.
Isn't it harmless?
No, Your Honor. We don't believe so.
Why not?
And the reason for that is there's a few reasons. The harmless error, as enunciated by this court in its recent decision in Miller, you have to find a fair assurance that the jury was not swayed by the error. It's not an issue
That's
of...
That's just words. Come on.
Well, Your Honor, this court doesn't sit as a second jury in that regard. And in that case, the
yes, look, that can't be your
well,
argument.
Your Honor,
then there'd be no harmless error. We're
never
well, I understand
second
that. Jury, right?
So. Understood, Your Honor. But this was not a sideshow, as the government tries to portray it in the case.
No. The question is whether the other evidence is so abundant that no reasonable jury would have acquitted.
And the evidence isn't so abundant, Your Honor. In this case, the centerpiece of the case, the absolutely critical piece, as enunciated by the district court, was Alton Marshall. I mean, I understand, Your Honor, this court gets a lot of co-defendants, and their credibility is challenged a lot when they cut deals. Alton Marshall is one of the most, perhaps the least credible person you may see in front of this court. This gentleman testified. He may have had eight different stories about what happened during the ISF robbery. First,
do you think the jury disbelieved him and convicted on the basis of the restaurant robberies? Is that your argument?
I don't believe the district court convicted Mr. Vance. So we don't know what the jury
You're not answering my question. Do you think the jury disbelieved Marshall and convicted on the basis of the restaurant robberies?
If your answer is solely on the right question, solely on the restaurant
it's
robberies,
it's a yes or no question.
I don't believe they convicted on the restaurant robberies. I do not. But I do believe the restaurant robberies were a factor. This is a situation where restaurant robberies are a situation where the government spent considerable time. Mr. Marshall's testimony about 10%
or more. If the jury had disbelieved Marshall, would it have convicted on the basis of, would it have convicted him?
If they disbelieved Marshall?
Yeah.
If they disbelieved Marshall, would they have convicted the...
Yeah, that's my question.
Disbelieving generally or solely about the restaurant robberies, Your Honor?
If they disbelieved his testimony about the banks,
would they have convicted him?
Right.
There was physical evidence as well, which we've challenged, Your Honor. But I don't think that this court's in a position to decide. I can't stand there and say what a jury would or would not do. What I can say, Your Honor, is that the restaurant robberies were a key component of the government's case. They put four witnesses on who talked about this menacing robber scouring Chicagoland. He's out in the western suburbs. He's on the west side. They're on the south side. They're coming into a quiet restaurant late in the evening, 9 or 10, maybe 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. And they're grabbing people's purses, and they're putting guns to their head as they're there to eat their Mexican food or their shrimp and that type of thing. That is a very prejudicial effect, and it has a fairly significant imprint.
Well, the district court thought that the identity was important, the fact that these three people knew each other, worked together, and obviously the night before the bank robbery, you know, it sounds crazy, but they just robbed three restaurants in a row and didn't get caught, I might add. But what about the identity issue, the fact that these people were, whatever you want to call it, long-time associates, and that they were working together on these? Is there some question about the identity of the people
I don't believe the identity...
Robbed the restaurants?
I don't believe the identity issue. First thing is, it's important to note that the restaurant robberies, none of the patrons there could identify Mr. Vance or Mr. Marshall because of masks. But the identity issue, we don't believe it holds water. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is that, first, the relationship between, in terms of their relationship, it's not like, this isn't like the Foster case where they grew up, their genesis of the relationship was crime. They've known each other for 30 years. That was undisputed in the papers and ultimately a trial. And even in opening statement, the government talks about how well Mr. Marshall and Mr. Vance know each other. Then with respect to, the government tries to say, okay, well, maybe it's not they knew each other. It's important that they had a criminal relationship before the robberies, because the restaurant robberies would show the evidence of their criminal relationship and how it developed from restaurants to riskier robberies like banks. But that doesn't hold water when you look at the facts of the case. Even if that theory, which I believe, mind you, would swallow the rule in terms of 404B evidence every time there's co-defendants in crime A and crime B. But even if that could be a theory, it doesn't work here. Because with respect to the Cole Taylor robbery, and that robbery is often ignored because Mr. Gibson, that doesn't relate to the death of Mr. Gibson. The Cole Taylor robbery took place on May 10th, but it began to be planned, including not just planning, overt acts in furtherance of it, including stealing a car, was somewhere between 2 to 6 days before the Cole Taylor robbery. So somewhere between May 4th and May 8th, not only was it planned, but a car was stolen to carry it out. So that relationship, so to speak, was in place before the restaurant robberies took place on the evening of May 9th. The restaurant robberies were not admitted to show the relationship between Mr. Vance and Mr. Marshall. They were in to show how bad of a guy Mr. Vance was.
But you have an uphill battle here, because you had Marshall's evidence, you had the DNA evidence, you had Davis's evidence, and other evidence. So, I don't know why the restaurant robberies were so important.
Well, Your Honor, we also believe, in addition to the restaurant robberies, that reversals required based on the district court's failure to satisfy its gatekeeping responsibilities under Rule 702.
You seem to think there's a requirement of an expert report?
I think there's a requirement
to conduct... Where did you get that from?
Your Honor, there has to be something. Whether
there
it
was
is,
something.
The something was argument of counsel. And that can't be gatekeeping, because you can't satisfy the government's burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the evidence should be admitted if it's argument of counsel and a letter from counsel.
But there was evidence from the expert also.
There was not evidence from the expert, Your Honor. There were papers.
Papers are evidence.
Your Honor, I would equate this to a civil case. And I'm mostly a civil lawyer.
No, don't equate it to a civil case.
Well, bear with me, Your Honor. In a situation where the issue in a civil case is whether, what does a gold contract say? And we ask for a discovery. I want all documents related to the gold contract. And your opposing party sends you 100,000 pages of documents that relate to the silver contract. And says, we've produced all the documents we have to produce. We gave them 100,000 pages. That should be plenty to determine what the issue is here. That's what they did to the court. The government produced a bunch of papers.
Are you saying that this evidence should have been excluded, or that the judge simply didn't consider its admissibility or sufficiently, or both, or what?
It's both, Your Honor, but we've been at this case solely based on the gatekeeping. We can't know. If the court doesn't do its gatekeeping, we don't know what should. The evidence might have been excluded. It might have been admitted. The judge could have determined, well, I'll admit this evidence, but Ms. Prajean can't testify that Mr. Gibson's DNA was on the same glove as Mr. Vance's DNA because of the commingling of the gloves. Because given the violations of FBI protocol, which were admitted, Ms. Prajean testified at trial that was, quote, not ideal for DNA. Excuse me, that was the FBI agent, how the evidence was handled. We simply can't know, when the gatekeeping isn't done, what would have done if the gatekeeping... We can't essentially say, well, if gatekeeping would have been done, maybe she would have admitted it. Maybe and maybe so, maybe partially, and maybe not. That's why gatekeeping is required, and you can't use arguments of counsel to get it in. You have to have something from the expert. Now, maybe a Daubert hearing, but I recognize the case law says you don't have to have the expert on the stand. But whether it's Lupton, whether it's Panzer, you have to do something to say what's going to go on here. And the district court recognized that, Your Honor. I quoted it in our briefs. I can't hear from lawyers. I have to hear from experts. You got to give me something over and over again. And then all she gets is a bunch of papers that are papers talking about what was done, but not addressing the reliability challenges raised by Mr. Vance, except for a 3-page letter from the United States Attorney. Now, not only is that letter insufficient when it comes from the attorney, not the expert, but that letter raised more questions than it answered. It seemed to raise questions as to whether Ms. Prajean even understood, you know, the exchange of DNA material under Locard's exchange principle. The district court reads the U.S. attorney's letter, says, well, I know you wrote this, so she recognized it didn't come from the expert, and said, wow, I'm amazed that Ms. Prajean, if she gave you some information that led you to write this, doesn't seem to understand this fundamental exchange principle. I thought she seemed to understand it before. I think I'm going to get into Daubert difficulty, and I'm paraphrasing here, Your Honor. I'm not saying the exact, but I think if I don't have a Daubert hearing of Ms. Prajean on the stand, despite all the statements about having to hear from experts, despite a letter which raised significant issues with respect to what Ms. Prajean did and didn't understand, the district court never heard from Prajean on the reliability
challenges.
Well,
we know what her view was. So is your proposition that she should have been subjected to cross-examination at the judge's hearings?
Your Honor, you can't wait till it comes to trial where essentially the jury is in there.
The trial.
I do believe Ms. Prajean...
These preliminary hearings regarding the admissibility of this evidence, they did reveal what her opinion was, right?
I don't believe they did, Your Honor.
Well,
if you look at the hearings...
Hey, don't interrupt me, would you please? She had no... I'm just looking at the government's brief. She had no scientific basis from which to assess the likelihood of this, you know, commingling. So we know that that was her view. Now, what in addition do you want? That she should actually have been examined about that at what would have amounted to a Daubert hearing? Is that what you want?
I think we actually have to hear from her directly as the view. Since that view, if you look at the hearing...
I'm sorry, you're not answering my question. We know what she thought about this commingling problem. Now, is it your notion that she had to had to testify about that before that evidence was allowed in the trial. Is that your proposition?
In light of the questions about
no,
the issue?
No, just answer yes
yeah, I do
no.
believe yes.
Would you please?
Yes.
Wasn't the bloody glove the one that she took the DNA from the inside of the glove as well as the outside of the glove?
Yes.
And so the inside of the glove, this commingling thing, would seem to isolate it so that it would be exclusive. And it's the bloody glove, which is clearly the blood of the deceased, and the DNA, as she testified, with a billion to one or something, was the inside and the outside. It was the same.
May I respond?
Yeah, please do.
I'm not a DNA expert. When you have commingling of gloves in violation of protocols, I think that's the kind of thing that would be tested. What's the likelihood of transfer between it? What's the possibility that DNA could be somewhere it isn't? What's the possibility that DNA, because it's in plastic, would have been degraded such that someone else's blood fire, whether it's Bluford or other, could have been off a glove that it otherwise would have been on? That's the kind of thing that would have been done at that hearing. Thank you.
Let me ask you a question about the sentence. I don't understand
yes, sir.
Your theory of the sentence. What do you think this rather garbled statute about life imprisonment? What do you think it means?
I think it's a statute that's got a lot of issues. But what I think it means, it should be interpreted, is that the death results from kidnapping. I say kidnapping, forced accompaniment could be short of kidnapping, but it should. When death results from a kidnapping, it's mandatory life imprisonment or death. If it's a killing, you have to give some meaning to the first part of the statute that says there's a 10-year minimum. But if you give
this means you kill a person, you have a 10-year minimum. But if you kill a person in the course of kidnapping, you have life imprisonment. What sense does that make?
I think it makes the first thing is a 10-year minimum doesn't mean he'll get 10. He could still get life, Your Honor. But
that's what I'm saying. But you can get only you can be lucky and be sentenced to only 10 years for killing someone. But if you do it in the course of a robbery, course of a kidnapping, you have a mandatory life imprisonment. Now my question is, what sense does that make?
I think it makes sense, and that Congress could have determined that a simple bank robbery, which doesn't involve grabbing
Wait,
someone,
I don't understand. You murder a person, you can get 10 years. You murder the person that you've kidnapped, you get life. I'm asking you what sense that makes.
I think when you're grabbing someone with the intention of holding them against their will, which includes other offenses in this statute that changes hostage taking, carjacking, Congress could determine that it is trying to deter grabbing people and attempting...
I don't understand. So murder, 10 years, relatively minor offense, you get less than the average federal drug sentence, but... if you kill a person you've kidnapped, then you have to get life. I just don't get the sense of that.
Well, Your Honor, in my view, it's not about whether we do or don't get the sense. It's about
Congress writing the statute. Well, if it doesn't make sense, it's probably not a correct interpretation. It's a garble. The statute is a garble. And the question is, what is the more sensible interpretation?
Your Honor, I would submit that an interpretation where you have two minimum punishments for the same crime and suggesting, by implication, that they're killings that don't result in death is a lot more absurd than a ruling that says kidnapping where someone dies is a higher minimum than someone being killed. That's my suggestion.
What's absurd? I don't understand. What did you just say?
The statute as written clearly has a 10-year minimum for killing any person. There's no way to read the statute any other way. Once that's the case, if you accept the government's proposition and the Sixth Circuit's decision in Parks, that death results modifies both killing and kidnapping, you have a 10-year minimum for killing and a life minimum for killing where death results. So that suggests, first, that's two sentences for the same crime, killing and killing where death results. One's 10 years, one's life. And you also, by implication, suggest that they're killings where death doesn't result. That's the way you'd have to interpret the statute if you accept the government's proposition and Parks. And I don't believe, under the absurdity doctrine, and under the rule of lenity, that this court should do so.
No, the rule of lenity doesn't apply. The rule of lenity would imply that somehow the defendant was familiar with the statute and interpreted the way you interpret it. That's not realistic. Nobody knew about the statute, right?
Your Honor,
you think he knew about the statute, and he and his behavior was influenced by his knowledge of the statute and the interpretation that you place on it. That would be your rule of lenity argument.
Your Honor, I believe under this court's decision.
No, it doesn't make any sense, right? Because he didn't know about the statute, and he didn't adopt your interpretation of it.
Your Honor, United States v. Taylor, I don't believe...
Look, what sense does it make? Maybe the law is asinine, but can you think of a reason why rule of lenity would sensibly apply in a situation where it's totally unrealistic to believe that the defendant knew or adopted this interpretation?
Your Honor, I would submit that that's the case in 99.9% of crimes. Defendants don't look at the statute and determine their behavior based on it. In United States v. Taylor, I don't think the defendant, in terms of what is and isn't sexual activity, looked at it and said, I'm not going to do my behavior, or I'm going to do my behavior based on what is and isn't. That's not the way the rule of lenity has been applied.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
So, Ms. Fairley?
May it please the Court, my name is Sharon Fairley and I represent the appellee of the United States of America. The District Court did not abuse its discretion when it admitted 404B evidence related to the three restaurant robberies that defendant David Vance participated in, along with his co-defendant Alton Marshall, on the night before the first of the two charged bank robberies.
Could you speak up a little bit, please?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Maybe you're too tall for the microphone, then.
You can raise the...
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. This evidence was properly admitted for the purpose of proving the identity. The fact that Vance was not only one of the three robbers in each of the three charged robberies, but he was also the robber that specifically jumped over the teller counter in the Illinois Service Federal Bank robbery and shot and killed Tremaine Gibson. The value
of
the evidence...
What's your notion that somehow if he jumped over a counter in the restaurant robbery, it would make it more likely that he was the person who jumped over the counter in the bank robbery? Is that the idea?
That is the idea, Your Honor. And Mr. Marshall explained it in his testimony at trial. He explained their division of responsibility, if you will, and he described it as this. He said, I did security for Vance. I watched his back while Vance was the one to approach the counter and go after the money. And that was the purpose.
This was the restaurant robbery?
This was describing his role in the restaurant robberies in general. But you can see that role play out in each of the two charged bank robberies as well. In the Cole Taylor bank robbery, he took care of the customers while Vance approached the counter. And, of course, we see in the video surveillance of the Cole Taylor bank, we see Vance holding a gun in front of the tellers. The same situation played out in the Illinois Service Federal Bank robbery. Marshall took down that one security guard that was inside the lobby of the bank, while Vance ran, jumped over the teller counter, and went back to the vault and accosted victim Tremaine Gibson.
Who shot the security guy at the bank?
I don't think the evidence was clear on that. We didn't have any ballistic information about that, so I don't think that that's necessarily clear in the record.
The bullet they recovered was from the customer, I believe, right?
That's correct.
I assume they weren't targeting her. Somebody just...
That's correct.
...ended up shooting her.
That's correct. She was
And that was the same bullet. I know they lost the bullet. That was the same bullet that killed the bank employee, right?
The ballistics testimony was the ballistics testing that the government had gotten with regard to that bullet was that it was consistent with the same gun that had fired the bullet that killed Tremaine Gibson, yes. But that was not ever presented. That evidence was not presented at trial.
Did they recover the bullet that killed the bank employee?
Yes, there was one bullet and one cartridge that was recovered from the vault area in the bank where Mr. Gibson was found dying.
So they got two bullets and lost one?
They got one bullet from, well, I should say they got several bullets and casings from the bank because there were several rounds fired. So there was a lot of ammunition that was recovered from the bank that day.
Oh.
The particular bullet that was recovered from the customer victim was not recovered from the bank. It was recovered later, I think it was about a week later, in the hospital. It was removed from her body.
Oh.
just ask you out of order question. He's sentenced to life imprisonment, but there are also conditions of supervised release. Is that a sort of Lazarus theory that he might come back to life after he died in prison? And
I'm not sure.
I mean, how could supervised release, which takes effect on release from prison, how could those conditions? What sense is it to impose those conditions in a where the defendant has life imprisonment?
Your Honor, I'm just imagining that the district court would impose these conditions of supervised release and impose a term of supervised release because it was allowable by statute in the event that one or more of the convictions was undermined, that the life was undermined on appeal, that there would still be a condition in place for him to have supervised release after the completion of his term on the other counts.
Well, but if there was some partial reversal on appeal, the case would go back to the district court for the imposition of a new sentence. And if that was a sentence of less than life imprisonment, then he would impose conditions of supervised release. Why impose them when the only sentence is a life sentence?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I can't.
But that wasn't discussed, I take it.
No, it was not.
Okay, thanks.
So again, the 404B evidence was, again, admitted to create this connection between Vance and Marshall, and in particular between Vance and the long-barreled revolver that was used in both the restaurant robberies as well as the charged offenses. Now, the district court, neither did the district court abuse its discretion when it admitted the government's DNA evidence and the associated expert testimony. The record just does not show that the district court abdicated its gatekeeping responsibilities here. There was hundreds of pages of documentation turned over with regard to the expert and her proposed testimony, and there were hours of oral argument on this issue.
So the judge had several hearings on this DNA issue, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Before the trial. Why didn't he want to hear from Prejean, is that how she pronounced it?
Yes, Prejean.
Prejean.
Christine
okay.
Prejean.
Is she not available or something? Or what?
No, I think the issue here, Your Honor, was that initially at least, the defendant really wasn't challenging the qualifications or the analysis of the analyst herself. Their initial challenge to the admissibility of the evidence and the expert testimony was to challenge the reliability of the underlying source material. Again,
the
here
underlying
they were,
what? I'm sorry.
The source material, the evidence
oh,
itself.
Oh, the source. Yeah.
And so here, the defendant was arguing that because of the government's purported lapses in the methods of collection of this evidence, that it rendered the evidence so unreliable as that it was not a proper basis for the expert testimony.
So there was no Ms. Fairley. So there was no defense fallback position that if that argument failed, that.
No, actually what ended up happening is, as prior counsel suggested, when the government did submit its expert disclosures that were meant to directly address these issues, right, that included this addressing the issue of the idea of the secondary transfer. And it was only then that the defendant challenged the expert herself in terms of her qualifications on the basis that her purported opinion about the concept of secondary transfer was so outside the scientific thought process on this issue that it rendered her unqualified. And, of course, the district court was proper in looking at the scientific views that the defendant presented on this issue and then compared them to the proposed testimony of the expert herself and found that they were not in conflict at all, and therefore there was no reason to find her unqualified.
Was there a request by the defense to produce in person during any of these hearings the expert?
I believe there was a request, but I think ultimately the district court found that the documentation and the proposed proffered testimony was sufficient to make these determinations. Again, like I said, there were two issues being debated here, right? One was the underlying reliability of the evidence itself, which really had not a lot to do with Prejean. There was one issue related to what Ms. Prejean did, and that was the complaint that she swabbed both the inside and the outside of the gloves with one swab. Right. And, of course, in our submissions, we explained, and she explained at trial the same way, that she did that because DNA evidence is not readily apparent, and she was trying to capture as much DNA material as possible. There was no way to determine which was the outside or which was the inside of the glove. They were latex gloves. So she did what she thought was most prudent to capture the most DNA material possible, and she swabbed both the inside and outside together.
Was it a mistake to use plastic bags rather than paper bags?
Absolutely.
Hold the gloves?
And that was acknowledged at trial, that when collecting DNA evidence, it is preferable to capture this evidence in paper versus plastic. And as Ms. Prejean did testify at trial, the reason for that is because when you place a DNA material, biological material, in plastic, it can cause degradation, right? But as Ms. Prejean explained, that degradation, what it does is it sort of makes the DNA more difficult to capture. So it would become more difficult to come up with a readable DNA profile from biological material that has been degraded after having been placed in plastic. But it doesn't change the nature of the DNA material itself. So
did she put the gloves in the bags or?
No, these were the FBI agents collected the evidence on scene near the getaway car. And they did acknowledge that. But again, the agent who collected the gloves testified at trial that she was thinking more that they were appropriate for fingerprinting rather than DNA collection, because she didn't see any biological material on the gloves. As you mentioned, Judge, the blood was on the inside of the inside glove, so there was no visible biological material that she saw that would make her think, oh, I need to put this in plastic, not paper. So in any event, the district court did not abuse its discretion in accepting the government's proffered testimony. As you've stated, there is no bright line rule that says that the district court has to pursue this Daubert inquiry in any particular way. And the court did review volumes of information and found that it was sufficient, and rightly so. getting on to the statute issue, we all can look at that statute and say, hey, it's inartful, awkward, yes, but I don't think it's unclear. It certainly isn't unclear, and that's why no court to have applied this aspect of the statute has followed defendant's reading or found it so ambiguous as to require that the rule of lenity be applied here. So unless there are any further questions, I will ask that the court please affirm defendant David Vance's conviction and his sentence.
Well, is the statutory problem because of, it's not really a redundancy, but it says a killing resulting in death. Is that, obviously that doesn't make much sense.
No.
But that seems to be the only real problem, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. And it is quite awkward. I mean, it's clear something, you know, was amiss here. But also, when you look at the legislative history, it becomes pretty clear how this happened, how this awkward language came to be. Is basically they just took words out of the statute that existed, and then they replaced them with new words that they were putting in place to make this statute, along with many others, to be consistent with the most recent death penalty procedures under the Federal Death Penalty Act. So even though we can look at it today and say, oh, this is very awkward and ambiguous, we can see clearly from the legislative history how the statute came to be the way it is.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Goodman, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute since we have a lot of questions. Do you have anything for us?
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it. Just a couple of points. With respect to the papers provided to the district court, we don't even know. Not only were they not on the reliability challenges, they were just on what Ms. Prejean did. We don't even know that they were considered by the district court. The only thing in the district court, there was the last hearing, there was the production, and there was the opinion. And the only thing that cited in the opinion is this three-page letter from Ms. Fairley to the district court, and not any of these additional papers that really weren't on point anyway. Second is there's a few references to abuse of discretion with respect to gatekeeping, that's a de novo standard of review with respect to whether the gatekeeping responsibilities were satisfied.
I'm sorry, two references to what?
Sorry, Ms. Fairley was referencing the abuse of discretion in terms of the admission of the evidence. That is the standard on the expert, the DNA evidence. That's the standard on the admission of the evidence, but with respect to whether gatekeeping was satisfied, it is a de novo standard of review. With respect to the restaurant robberies, the argument on the division of responsibility both doesn't satisfy, essentially, it's really a modus operandi argument, doesn't satisfy the modus operandi case law, especially the bank robbery cases we've cited, Carroll, Luna. They aren't from the circuit, but they're really on all fours in terms of the facts, Myers, Lael, four different circuits. And even with respect to, even if a division of responsibility of who rushes the counter, who doesn't, could be enough under 404B, it doesn't even fit the facts here. There were only three restaurant robberies. Marshall testified that in one of those robberies, both Marshall and Vance rushed the counter. So even if that could be modus operandi or identity, they didn't even have the same roles in every restaurant robbery. So it couldn't be a basis for admission under the identity because they weren't even consistent within his own testimony.
So what happened to the other two robberies?
The other two robberies, according to Marshall, Vance did rush the counter, but not the third. And the last thing is with respect to the statutory argument. The only court that really considered the issue, the analysis, is Parks. The other ones just, without analysis, say, provides for life imprisonment, but it doesn't appear, at least from the opinion, that the issue was raised.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Goodman. You were appointed, were you not?
I was, thank you.
Yes, well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of
Thank you.
And, of course, we thank Ms.